music and talk radio about all things, all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
Good morning, and welcome to Intravenous here on Campus Community Radio, CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University on the Burnaby campus, where we are on the unceded lands of the Kwikwetlem, the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh peoples. I'm Robin. And I am here to introduce the program content that you will hear today. Similar to last week's program, we've had the great privilege of rebroadcasting an audio file that was recorded by SFU Public Square. This one is the President's faculty lecture with Dr. Victoria Thomas that happened February 13th, entitled Transformative Justice, a Revolutionary Praxis for Reducing Anti-Trans Sentiment. President's faculty lectures shine a light on the research excellence at Simon Fraser University, and they are hosted by SFU President Joy Johnson. These free public lectures celebrate the cutting-edge research and researchers that engage with communities and mobilize knowledge to make real-world impacts. The bio for Dr. Victoria Thomas speaks to that mandate. She is an assistant professor of media communication and public engagement in the School of Communication. She examines representations of Black, transgender, and gender nonconforming identities in our contemporary moment of anti-trans legislation and media hypervisibility of sexual orientation and gender identity politics. Her first book project, Trans Inclusive Television, Black Television Culture and the Politics of Gender Nonconforming Identities, analyzes representations of Black, transgender, and gender nonconforming individuals in U.S. cable and streaming television programs. We will hear Dr. Thomas's lecture in its entirety today on the program, followed by a few questions from the in-person as well as the online audience, facilitated by SFU President Joy Johnson. Here we go.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining me both online and in person. I look forward to discussing a little bit of my research with you this evening. First of all, I do want to say thank you to the Public Square staff. They have been very helpful as I prepare this lecture. I also want to say thank you to my colleagues in the School of Communication for their support of my research, as well as the Digital Democracies Institute for their support as well. So tonight I will discuss a small component of my research. As I begin this lecture, I want to ask you to suspend your first judgment. Suspending your first judgment provides you the space to connect, imagine, and discover new possibilities for making life livable for trans people of color. So we can kind of start this idea of thinking about visibility for trans people, in particular around 2014. So this was the year that the article was released in the Time magazine in which Laverne Cox is quoted as saying, "It is revolutionary for any trans person to choose to be seen and visible in a world that tells us we should not exist." So this transgender tipping point alluded to an era within America and hopefully the world where we were on the edge of a new civil rights frontier, where we were thinking about inclusion into civil society. However, the transgender tipping point points to civil rights, i.e. state intervention, as the only answer to fixing discrimination and moving forward to a new frontier. This motion kind of takes the power from the majority and puts this in the hands of a very small majority to make social change. And as we know, this transgender tipping point kind of led us into this area of what we call visibility. So 4 years later, we see that Laverne Cox has made it on another cover. And in particular, this cover was for Cosmopolitan South Africa. So we see that these particular individuals are not just seen in America, but they're starting to be globally seen. And this was also the same year that the TV show Pose debuted on cable televisions, which is a show that focuses on the ballroom community in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. And so that was kind of the first time we started to see more than one trans person on TV. And so this kind of led us to this particular moment around 2020, in which we can call the hypervisibility moment. And so we see the proliferation of lots of trans women. And here on this cover of Marie Claire, and as we can see, these are very influential magazines, right? These are magazines that people know globally and see. And so Janet Mock was on this particular cover because 13 years later, her particular story about her being a trans woman came out in Marie Claire. However, that particular story used a lot of transphobic rhetoric. And so she reflects on what it meant for her to be seen at that particular time, as well as where have we gone since that particular moment, right? And so when we think about 2020, we can think about this also being the surge of a lot of the anti-trans bands. So we see this moment of visibility move to this moment of hyper-visibility. So here right now we have an image from 2021, of Sports Illustrated. This is of Lena Bloom. She happens to be the very first transgender Sports Illustrated model. And this came out in 2021. We also see in 2021, Bazaar magazine, which we know is a very influential fashion magazine, featured some of the women from Pose. And as we can see, all of these are Black trans women. And so this takes us up until 2022, where we have this Vogue cover, which is Vogue British. As we know, that is a huge, huge cover. And we have on this particular cover Yasmin Finney, who is a Black trans actress in the UK. She is the very first trans actress to be on Doctor Who. And so we see all of these moments of visibility and hypervisibility, in particular with Black trans women. And so part of this understanding of hypervisibility is to kind of understand that it doesn't necessarily equate to something good. Here we have a quote from Aya Simone, who is a Black transgender woman from Detroit. And she talks about hypervisibility doesn't always mean that people are safe. It means that you can also be vulnerable to violence and it makes you a target. So if we think about all of these trans women being on these particular covers, starting in 2014, moving to this moment of hypervisibility in 2020, we can see the connections between some of these anti-trans laws that occurred. And so I just want to make sure we kind of understand that hypervisibility is simply the state of being extremely visible. And in particular, if we think about trans people and if we think about the population, it is a very small population. And this idea of hypervisibility became so prominent that in August 2020, Google Trends Data released a very short film titled Black Trans Lives Matter. And in this particular film, they illustrated what were some of the search terms, what were people looking for in 2020. And some of those search terms were trans women are women, Black trans people killed, and trans activists. And that was also the year that the American Medical Association declared that violence against Black trans women was an epidemic. And so just to kind of get us into thinking about the population, if we look at this particular statistic, we can see the actual amount of trans people who are actually in the U.S. In particular, we can see that the U.S. adult trans population is 1.3 million. And the U.S. population right now is roughly about 300 million. We can also see that the youth population is maybe 300K. So we're talking about a very, very small population that is being hyper-visible. And in particular, when we talk about Black trans women, Black trans non-binary identities, we have 0.6% of the population. However, we know that Black trans people, in particular Black trans women, are the majority of the people who are experiencing violence, even though they are a very, very small number of the population. And so reports have shown that Black transgender women and non-binary people are mostly supported by their family and not by public. So you will see a lot of familial support, and I'll talk a little bit about how that pushes back against some of this particular hate. So if we think about moving from this concept of hypervisibility, we move to this concept of backlash. And in particular, we have a quote here from Laverne Cox, who looked back at her Time magazine in 2014, and this is what she says. In 2023, we are at the height of the backlash against transgender visibility. We have more people who are educated about trans folks, but there's also a rigorous misinformation media machine. The backlash is ferocious and it is genocidal. And so, like I said, when we think about this concept of genocidal, we want to remember we are really talking about a very, very small population. So at the particular rate we're going, we're really moving towards this idea of these individuals being extinct if we continue to go at these particular rates. And so the harm of these media messages, even though they may seem like they're showing Black trans women living their best life, Black trans women having opportunities, is that they kind of instruct viewers how to treat trans people. And like I said, these are these particular magazines showcase, like I said, the Black trans people who are living their best life. But we have to think about the Black trans people who are not on these covers, the Black trans people who we will interact with every day. And so in the last decade, we know that trans people have become more and more visible in our media, our school, our political conversations, and our workplaces. And we know that many of the world will not meet trans people, right? So like I said, this is a very small percentage of the population, which means the majority of people will not know a trans person. And so these are the messages and these are the ideologies that they take that teach them how to treat people. And another vein of my research also looks at the ways in which we can think about how television produces these, in particular because Laverne Cox was on television. And if we look at the proliferation of trans women, we're seeing them in television way more than we're seeing them in films. And as we know, television is an everyday practice, and it is something that we watch over and over again. And so a lot of the rise of anti-trans bills occurred in 2020. We were in a pandemic. We were stuck at home. We were watching media, right? And so we can see how consuming that much media contributed to a lot of these people pushing these anti-trans ideologies. And so it's important to understand that the dehumanization of trans people is going to begin with this anti-trans sentiment, right? So we're talking about a hostile political climate combined with cultural marginalization and invisibility. And so when I think about cultural marginalization, that just means the act of treating a person as if they are insignificant or isolating them or disempowering them. And then, like I said, this media hypervisibility in which we're seeing so many Black trans women on our televisions makes us feel as if they're everywhere. And all of this really leads to a lot of the homelessness that we see for Black trans individuals, unemployment. We also see a disproportionate representation of them in our prison systems, incarceration, as well as harassment and violence. And so this particular phenomenon has been coined as trans misogynoir. So this particular term takes from a trans woman who takes it from a Black woman, Moya Bailey, to describe the ways in which experiences of anti-Blackness, cissexism, and misogyny form this unique system of oppression. And as Ashley Marie Preston says, who is a trans writer, she's wrote for the magazine Bazaar, this particular term shows this intersection of misogyny, transphobia, anti-Blackness. And it's not just something that is a social problem. It is built into our systems. And so I'm going to read you a quote from Ashley's story about how this became systemic for her. In 2014, at 19 years old, I left my hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, and I headed for Los Angeles. Moving across the country with no family or social support in place might deter someone else from taking that leap, but the safety net that they perhaps felt they were leaving behind didn't exist for me. What I didn't have the language to characterize trans identity back then, I knew that in Kentucky, exploring any identity outside of the default was everything but safe. I soon come to discover that random hate I feared wasn't exclusive to an isolated region of the country, but was actually a symptom of a global ailment. In LA, I settled in quite seamlessly. I found a small apartment, a job in retail, and more important, my tribe. Once I understood that there was an entire international community of people like me, I felt empowered, as if I could take on the world. Yet, after transitioning on the job, I was harassed, bullied, and eventually fired. My gender expression was blamed for the hostile work environment. I lost my apartment and ended up homeless and on the streets of Hollywood. I went to women's shelters for refuge, but my definition of womanhood didn't align with theirs, and I was turned away. Deflated, dejected, and afraid for my safety and well-being, I went to men's shelters for help. For the most part, I was turned away because of my cis passability as a woman. Throughout my time on the streets, a couple of men's shelters opened their doors to me. Both times I was sexually assaulted, once by a security guard and another employee, and again by an overnight staff member. So here we see how those particular systems align, right? Her job discrimination, her housing situation, and even these social systems that are set up to help homeless people couldn't help her because there was no way, because a lot of our social systems are structured by gender. And if trans people push against this, and then there are no spaces for them to exist. And so, like she says, all Black trans women truly have is one another, because we've been exiled from every sector of society. So trans misogynoir is an epidemic within an epidemic. Another way to think about how systems fail is to kind of think of hate crime laws in the US. So here we have an image from 2008 that tracks the hate crime laws, and this is prior to the transgender tipping point. So what you'll notice is that there, at that time, there were only 12 states that had laws protecting trans people. And it's important to also look at the idea that there were 5 states that had no hate crimes whatsoever. And so in particular, if we think about the things that were happening to Ashley, and at that time she was living in Detroit, and if we look at where Michigan is, we can see that there was very little help and support for her. And let's jump ahead to 2023. Right? So this is after the transgender tipping point. So we have to ask ourselves, what has changed since this transgender tipping point when it comes to these particular laws that kind of show how this system is created to disadvantage? What we do notice is that more states now have civil protections, right? We went from 12 to 22. We also know that one of the states that had no hate crime laws, which was Georgia, which is my home state, now has a hate crime law that was passed in 2020. This particular law was passed because of the death of Ahmaud Arbery, who was a Black man who was basically hunted down by white supremacists and killed. So this was kind of the reason why Georgia decided to pass this law. It wasn't because of trans people. It was because of this particular racial incident that was happening during the epidemic of Black Lives Matter uprisings. I also want to point to the idea that Pennsylvania previously had a law, and now they don't. So we see one state that was there for trans people prior to this tipping point, but now that we've moved to this backlash, we see that Pennsylvania no longer offers these particular protections. And so I'm gonna hone in on a couple of case studies of how these particular systems have failed particular individuals. So the first case study is Kamora Stubble. So in July 2018, she was harassed while she was at a gas station. In particular, she was harassed by a Black cisgender man who threatened her with a gun. She described her attack as using homophobic rhetoric in nature, including calling her a man and asking to see her penis. And so after he did this, he pulled out a gun. There was a scuffle, and in the end, she ended up being shot. He was charged with the shooting. He was also charged with, at the time, what Michigan calls an ethic intimidation, which was their hate crime laws. However, in 2020, the Michigan Court of Appeals ruled that transgender people were not included. And so they said that the particular law found that gender only applies to masculine, feminine, and neutral genders. So because she was transgender, this law doesn't apply to her. So that meant that the hate crime charge was overturned. Another case we see is from Kelly Stowe, also in Michigan, also in Detroit. She was murdered in December 2018 at the age of 36. She was, in fact, murdered by a pastor. And so here we're starting to see also these systems of religion come into play to once again fail, right? When we think about churches, we think about places of refugees, we think about places where people can get support. But in particular, she was killed by a pastor who claimed it was self-defense. Turns out that the pastor was a frequent flyer of sex workers, and in particular, trans sex workers, right? His desire for trans individuals kind of led him there. But a lot of the women there says he was known for being aggressive with the women, and he had a reputation for not paying the sex workers he hired, right? So we're also seeing the economics come into play in particular in this thing. He was only sentenced to 8 years in prison for murdering Kelly. So when we think about the particular system of either there is no hate crime charge and the person gets away, or they are able to take away the hate crime charge and we see a particular person murder someone and only get 8 years. This is less time than Gypsy Rose got. And she didn't even kill her mother. She just planned it, right? This is also less time than Elizabeth Holmes got. And she just stole money from a bunch of billionaires, right? So we have a system that is once again telling trans people, not only will we make it hard for you to live, but if you die, there are no consequences, right? And let's be honest, with good behavior, he'll probably be out in 5 years, right? Right back on the streets to kind of do the same thing. And so it's important to also note that these particular individuals, like I said, have family support and were loved. So these are not just throwaway individuals. These are people who people deeply care about. And we have a quote here from Kelly's mother where she says, I just wanted to hear him admit it. I want to know, did you say a prayer with her before you left her out in the street like trash? After he murdered her, he just dumped her body in the street and she was found around 6 a.m. later that day. And did you at least hold her hand and tell her that you're sorry, right? And in particular, what she wants us to know is that she was cared for, she was loved. Right. And so even though these individuals are being murdered like they don't matter, they have family and they matter to their family, which is why it's important for us to think about the ways in which we are either contributing to this violence or we are preventing this particular violence. Also, Kelly has support from her grandmother. Right. Her grandmother told her to be the best version of herself that she could be, to own who she was and just live her life and be happy. And so a lot of times when people talk about the trans community, they try to make it seem as if older generations don't get it, as if older generations are the problem. They're not, right? A lot of these trans people have support from immediate family and their extended family. It's really the public spaces that make it hard for them to live. And in particular, Kelly's grandmother points to this anti-trans sentiment around desiring trans people. This idea that trans people are not desirable, that trans people are not loved and cared for, right? So even her grandmother was like, if you're attracted to that population, it's okay. Let's own it, right? And so this brings in the ways in which masculinity also contributes to a lot of the deaths that we see of Black trans women. And so here we are in October 2023, right? And we're starting to see more and more deaths of trans women. All of these deaths and these things happen in 1 month, right? And we know about October is that it is National Coming Out Day in the U.S., right? So it's a moment in which people are supposed to be okay celebrating who they are. But we see these back-to-back deaths, right? And what's important is that a lot of these deaths are by gun, right? There's a lot of gun violence that occurs. And we know that the U.S. in particular lacks a lot of gun laws. So a lot of the violence that occurred is via guns. And so we know that particular system is also threatening trans women. And so if we look at a decade of visibility, we can see how these particular numbers are increasing, right? So if we think about 2015, we can see that out of the 21 murder, 14 of them were Black trans women. We think about 2016, 10 out of 23 transgender individuals. So Black trans women make up the majority of the deaths. And like I said, if we think about 2020 in particular, which shows the ways in which this anti-sentiment came to pass, it doesn't make sense that in a year when most of the world was locked down, that we had 44 trans people murdered and 23 of them were Black, right? So even in times where there is no interaction, Black trans people are still being murdered. And these rates are just getting worse and worse, right? These are not things that are getting better, but these are things that are getting worse. And like I said, if the court systems are not going to punish these individuals, if the court systems are not going to pass laws that protect these individuals, then we're going to see more and more of these numbers a decade from now. And so the fatal consequences of transmissioneur leads us to really think about this concept of transformative justice. I mean, in particular, this is a concept that came from Mia Mingus in 2019, in which she really thinks about how we can transform these societal conditions. And in particular, she describes the idea that these are not things we can do with the current systems. These are not things that we can do. I can't go to a court system and say, fix this law. Because even if the law is fixed, it could change, right? A lot of these laws are in flux. They're never permanent. Things can be okay one day and things are not okay the next. And so it's not really going to make sense for us to put all of our faith into these particular systems. And so we have to build alternatives to these current systems. And we have to think about how can we break this generational violence. And community becomes hugely important for that particular thing. And so when we think about transformative justice, it doesn't rely on interventions from the state. Like I said, the state has proven time and time again that they don't have the resources or they don't have the actual power to affect real change in the lives. They only have the power to affect civil changes. And like I said, civil laws aren't going to make it safer for trans as much as teaching and having individuals do better with our community. And a good example of this is recently there was a case that happened in October 22 with Daria Bloodworth, who left Colorado and fled to Canada and applied for refugee status as a trans woman. She was afraid of the gun laws and she was afraid of a lot of the anti-trans legislation. She was granted a refugee status, but it was overturned by the Minister of Citizenship because he said that she failed to identify any gaps in Colorado's laws, which includes state level laws to protect transgender individuals. So here we have even a Canada court saying there are laws to protect you. There is a system. And so if you can't access this system properly, then we can't help you. Even though we know, even if they did access the system properly, it still wouldn't help. She appealed, but the appellate judge agreed and said that she did not demonstrate with clear and convincing evidence that she exhausted the course of action reasonably available to her without success. So she has been since deported back to the U.S. So here we see two systems that are not helping. And so we have another failure for trans people to seek asylum outside of their home. And like I said, this is a decision that is made by a very small few, right? A judge is interpreting a law, politicians are interpreting a law, but they can only work within the system that they are given, right? The only way to fix this is to work outside that particular system. And so one of the organizations that does a really good job of thinking through ways in which we can move beyond the systems and think about transformative justice is the Trans Women of Color Collective. It's an organization that started in DC by Black transgender women who create economic opportunities and affirming spaces for trans women. They have food pantries in Detroit. They have safe houses in DC, Missouri, and Jamaica. So they're creating a lot of these community spaces globally to support trans people. So these ideas of safe houses and these idea of making sure that they have meals and access to computer labs and counseling and mentoring are really what's going to allow them to have more livable lives. Another reason why transformative justice is important is because it does not reinforce or perpetuate violence such as oppressive norms or vigilantism. And we saw the vigilantism that happened when Kamore Stobo was shot, right? The person was policing her gender. He didn't like it, and he decided to act. And the one thing that hypervisibility of Black trans women has